Bonjour, donc bienvenue pour notre quatrième et dernière leçon du professeur Carr sur la manière de comprendre les textes bibliques à partir de théories sur le trauma, le traumatisme. Et aujourd'hui, après avoir parlé, mais je crois qu'il va vous le résumer aussi un peu, après avoir parlé de l'époque assyrienne, l'époque babylonienne et perse, nous allons maintenant nous avancer quelques siècles plus tard vers l'époque romaine et une tentative de comprendre la naissance du christianisme à côté du judaïsme aussi comme une sorte de reflet face à une expérience traumatisante de l'Empire romain. David.
Merci beaucoup, Thomas. Bonjour, madame et monsieur. Le but de cette leçon est assez ambitieux. Je souhaite expliquer en 45 minutes environ, plus quelques résumés français de Thomas Romer, les origines du judaïsme et du christianisme comme différentes réactions juives au traumatisme romain. En raison des limites des temps, je ne vais pas répéter mes définitions antérieures du traumatisme et la description de ses effets. En lieu de cela, je commencerai par une brève description de la destruction romaine du Second Temple et de la plupart des types de judaïsme du Second Temple. Et je décrirai comment le judaïsme et le christianisme ont émergé, comme les repensées différentes à ces traumas imposés par Rome. Avant cela, il y avait divers types de judaïsme et de groupes juifs, sadducéens, pharisiens, essiens, esséniens, gnostiques, diverses formes de révolutionnaires, des disciples de Jésus comme Paul ou Pierre et d'autres. Ces groupes étaient en désaccord sur plusieurs points, mais ils étaient reliés néanmoins par leurs relations variées à Jérusalem et son temple. Après ce traumatisme romain, seules deux branches principales de cette matrice religieuse ont survécu. Le judaïsme rabbinique d'une part et le christianisme de l'autre. Dans cette leçon, j'ai expliqué comment chacun a été forgé par ce traumatisme romain. Je soutiendrai que ces deux religions sont définies par les différentes façons dont elles puissent dans les ressources des Écritures en hébreu pour répondre au traumatisme de la destruction romaine du judaïsme des Second Temple. Le judaïsme rabbinique s'est concentré sur la Torah. Il s'est concentré particulièrement sur la vision exilique de la Torah d'Israël en tant que peuple élu qui était séparé des peuples étrangers autour de lui. Le mouvement de Jésus a également valorisé la Torah. Néanmoins, ces Juifs liés à Jésus ont pensé que Moïse est la personne dont parle le poème se retire souffrant de deuxième Ésaïe. Ésaïe 53. Les Juifs qui suivaient Jésus utilisaient cette image de Moïse comme un serviteur souffrant pour comprendre le sens de l'exécution de Jésus par les Romains. Cette image de Moïse a également aidé ces mouvements de Jésus à interpréter la persécution romaine de leur mouvement. À fin du premier siècle ou début du deuxième siècle, le judaïsme rabbinique est reconnu par Rome comme un judaïsme légitime. à peu près au même moment, Rome définissait indirectement les membres du mouvement de Jésus comme un nouveau groupe non-juif. Les Romains se moquaient les disciples de Jésus, les considéraient comme des rebelles et les appelaient chrétiens plutôt que juifs. Finalement, ces juifs qui ont suivi Jésus en sont venus à embrasser leur identité en tant que religion distincte non-juive. En effet, ils ont adopté pour eux-mêmes le terme romain péjoratif des chrétiens et ont revendiqué leur statut de véritables héritiers des écritures hébraïques et de leurs promesses. Alors, en anglais. So let me turn now to the Roman destruction of Jerusalem, its temple, and any form of Judaism that was focused on either. Like the earlier Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and its first temple, which I discussed in earlier lectures, this Roman devastation of Second Temple Judaism was explosive and haunting in a way that qualifies as technically traumatic, not just painful. Now, as in the Babylonian destruction, this Roman obliteration of Second Temple Judaism was a longer process that later came to be seen in a single event. But before I launch into this, please click. Oh, okay. Before I launch into this, I need to make a couple of notes about how Rome viewed Judaism before this crisis happened. Can you click through to the rest of the slide? There we go. That's what I need. Thank you. Because before this point, Rome gave Judaism a special exception to the Roman requirement to worship imperial gods and other gods. Judaism was recognized as an ancient religion, and so Jews were allowed to continue their monotheistic religion and not worship imperial gods as long as they did not try to convert anyone else to their monotheistic perspective. So in a sense, Judaism, from the Roman perspective, was viewed as legalized atheism, as long as it stayed a non-missionary movement. This becomes important later as we discuss developments. But let's turn now to what happened to this difficult, complicated agreement between Rome and Judaism. And one of the first elements in the crisis was an increasing conflict between Palestinian Jews and a series of very incompetent Roman governors who were appointed, it seems, largely on the basis of their patronage and never are heard again after they are governors of Palestine. And then there was a particular crisis that emerged in the 40s CE when the Roman Emperor Caligula ordered that a statue of him be erected in Jerusalem, which conflicted with their beliefs about images. Finally, there was a conflict between Jewish and non-Jewish inhabitants of Caesarea that started in 64 CE, gradually spiraled out of control and resulted in a Jewish insurrection that successfully expelled the Roman forces from Palestine for a time. Emperor Nero dispatched 3 Roman legions to quell the rebellion, and they succeeded in retaking most of Palestine at the time. But then Nero died, and the general who was in charge of this reconquest of Palestine, Vespasian, paused his counterinsurgency so he could return to Rome to seize imperial power for himself. Once he was made emperor, he commissioned his son, Titus, to return to Palestine in March of 70 CE to finish the job of quelling the Jewish rebellion. Eager to make Jerusalem an example, Titus did not merely lay siege to the city and starve the rebels out. Instead, he set the full power of his Roman legions into a frontal assault on the city, seizing it quickly at the cost of the lives of many Roman soldiers. Now, we should be clear that this was not a purely local affair, not just limited to Palestine. Already, the Jews' successful expulsion of Roman forces from Palestine was a threatening challenge to the reputation Romans had for being invincible. And because the quelling of this rebellion came at the outset of the Emperor Vespasian's rule, his destruction of Jerusalem was taken by his reign as a founding moment in his entire dynasty. It signified the awesome military power of Rome and the awful fate that would happen to anyone who dared defy it. Thus, the destruction of Jerusalem was not just a calamitous, painful event. It became a virtually mythic event in Roman ideology, the paradigmatic destruction of all who would oppose Rome. In the aftermath of this destruction, Rome erected an arch in Rome itself, which still stands, the Arch of Titus, to commemorate the suppression of the Jewish revolt. This arch included a famous depiction on the inside of the Roman removal of the treasures from the Temple of Jerusalem in flames. This image includes a prominent menorah that you can see in this image, a shewbread table, and trumpets. And originally, this picture was gilded in gold with a blue background. For those people who couldn't go to Rome to see this arch, the Romans also printed and circulated across the entire Roman Empire Judaea Capta coins, Capture of Judah coins, with pictures of the victorious Emperor Vespasian on one side and a weeping Jerusalem under a palm on the other side, to publicize Rome's conquest to those who lived further abroad. As if to make the point, a Jew stands to the left of the palm there with hands bound behind his back to symbolize being subjugated by Rome. These kinds of coins have images that speak louder than words to a largely non-literate audience of the Roman Empire. They were issued for an entire quarter century, 25 years after the event, in the reigns of Titus and his brother Domitian. And you can see a couple of examples of coins from a later period here. Meanwhile, Jews scattered across the Roman Empire were ever more seen in this context as rebels and criminals. They were blamed just months after the destruction of Jerusalem for a large fire that occurred in Antioch, which was one of the largest Roman imperial cities. And Antioch's Jewish community and the Jewish communities of other major Roman cities then came under sustained attack by their non-Jewish neighbors. As also, in the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple, Jews across the empire were punished for the rebellion through the imposition on them of a special tax, the Fiscus Judaicus, a Jewish poll tax that was used to pay for a temple to Jupiter in Rome. So this would have felt like a double insult to Jews. On the one hand, they not only had to pay the money to the Romans, but their money went to support a pagan temple. I'll come back to this tax later. There was one other major Jewish revolt in Palestine a few decades later, when the Romans built a temple to Jupiter on the site of the former temple to Yahweh in Jerusalem and renamed Jerusalem Aella Capitolina. At this point, a figure claiming to be the Messiah, Bar Kokhba, successfully gained the support of some of Judaism's greatest rabbis, Akiba among them, and led a revolt that again temporarily expelled Romans from the land. But again, this expulsion was only temporary. In 134, Emperor Hadrian sends his legions in. They wiped out Bar Kokhba's forces, killed hundreds of thousands of Judeans, virtually a genocide of the population of Judah. And Jerusalem was sown with salt, and Jews were forbidden to, on pain of death, to even set foot in the holy city. Circumcision, Sabbath, Torah reading were forbidden. And once again, coins were cast commemorating this further destruction of rebellious Jews. If you can click to the next slide. Oh no, I'm sorry. Okay, let me pause to let Thomas summarize some.
Voilà, donc la destruction du temple, deuxième destruction du temple par les Romains en 70, a une préhistoire, donc c'est pas tombé comme cela. D'abord, le judaïsme avait un statut de religion protégée par les Romains, à condition qu'on fasse pas du prosélytisme. Mais les problèmes commencent à partir des années 40, où il y a des gouverneurs pas très compétents qui provoquent en fait des premières révoltes. Une grande révolte qui éclate en Césarée va en effet finalement amener la destruction du temple par Vespasien ou son fils Tite en 70. C'est un événement que les Romains ont utilisé non pas simplement comme un événement local, mais aussi pour montrer en fait leur puissance et l'ont en effet publié partout. Donc vous avez vu les images de l'arc de Tite à Rome avec la menorah qui était donc déportée du temple, mais aussi dans les monnaies qui circulaient. Et ces monnaies servaient aussi plus tard donc, à demander aux Juifs de payer une taxe spéciale qui servait à financer un temple de Jupiter, ce qui était évidemment une double insulte, d'abord un impôt spécial juif, et puis pour financer un temple de Jupiter. Et lorsque ce temple a été détruit dans les années 90, ça provoque en fait ensuite la révolte de Bar Kokhba, suite à laquelle en fait il y a de nouveau donc une intervention très dure des Romains qui maintenant en fait interdisent la circoncision, l'exercice de la religion juive et considèrent maintenant les Juifs comme étant les rebelles responsables de tous les maux qui peuvent arriver à l'Empire.
Merci. So, as you can imagine, this entire process was devastating to Jews and Judaism across the Roman realm. A major part of the populace of Judaism, both inside and outside Palestine, died. In addition, Jerusalem and its temple, which had served as a central orientation point for the diverse forms of Judaism during this period, was gone. In the post-temple age, Jews were united pretty much only by their adherence to the Torah, a common ethnic heritage, and their common obligation to pay the Roman Fiscus Judaicus temple tax. Not only that, but Jews during this period now bore the intense hostility of their neighbors for their Judean identity. These Jews now were symbols of a failed rebellion against Rome. They were arsonists. They were atheists, denying the imperial and other gods. Yet, there was a core of Jews who began to build a new Jewish identity that could survive even this catastrophe. Ironically enough, they appear to have been centered in a little town, Yavne, where the Romans had settled defectors from the first major revolt of Judah against Rome. Among these defectors from the Jewish revolt were some Pharisaic rabbis who became the founders of contemporary Judaism. This rabbinic academy, started at Yavne, represented a new way to seek Jewish identity in a world where anti-Roman war and party divisions in Judaism had proved disastrous. Where once Jews had the temple and the Sanhedrin as orientation points, now there was this academy of sages deliberating over the central matters of Jewish practice. And these rabbis, these wise ones, did not exclude any Jew on principle from their discussions. The only ones that they pronounced judgment on were Jewish groups called minim by the rabbis that refused to participate in the discussion or submit to the group opinions in that discussion on Jewish legal matters. Thus, in this way, was founded a tradition of rabbinic learning that started quite small, but embraced much of Judaism in the Holy Land within a couple of centuries, and expanded out to include surviving Jewish communities in the diaspora as time went on. This emergent rabbinic academy developed a post-temple form of Judaism that could survive the loss of the temple and expulsion from Jerusalem. In this, the rabbis continued and expanded on the religious innovations begun by their ancestors in Babylonian exile, covered in my last two lessons. Earlier, the Judean exiles in Babylon had been forced to develop a form of communal life that was no longer state-oriented, that didn't require a king or a land. They came to understand themselves in exile in Babylon, and here again I'm stepping back a number of years, to understand themselves as a holy, pure people, a priesthood among nations, bound by rules of purity that at one time had only applied to priests. This non-monarchical priestly vision of Israel, found in the trauma-shaped Pentateuch, was the model that helped the rabbis in the Roman period reshape Judaism in the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple. And the result of their deliberations was Judaism as we now know it. This Judaism, of course, had now shifted its idea of scripture, because not only did the Pharisees and other wise ones in this period affirm the Hebrew scriptures, but they began to compile a new set of secondary scriptures based on their oral deliberations, but eventually written down as the Mishnah and the Tosefta and the two Talmuds and so on. And these written rabbinic texts came to play as important or more important a role in guiding Jewish life in terms of legal stuff as the Tanakh originally had. In retrospect, the founders of Judaism in this period look like giants. The tradition they set in motion encompasses libraries of volumes, and of course their Jewish heirs number in the millions. But this impressive tradition has its roots in a handful of scholars and their followers working in Yavne and then other Babylonian and Palestinian communities. These scholars had little to work with at the time other than their mastery of Jewish biblical and other traditions that had been formed in the crucible of centuries of trauma. Eventually, the rabbinic Judaism founded in the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple embraced thousands and millions of people and survived centuries more of brutal persecution, a very resilient religious tradition forged in this period. Let me pause again.
Donc la destruction du temple en 70 mettait en question en fait un symbole d'identité pour les judaïsmes dispersés en diaspora et aussi dans le pays, et donc restait en fait au début que la Torah et ce taxe juif que les juifs avaient à payer. La réponse à cela, ce sera en fait le judaïsme tel que nous le connaissons, à savoir une sorte d'académie des pharisiens qui va être fondée à Yavne, en Galilée, où d'abord un tout petit groupe de ce qui vont devenir les rabbins se réunissait et commençait en fait pas simplement à compiler les textes bibliques, mais en fait d'inventer de nouveaux textes qui interprétaient ce texte qui était eux aussi le résultat d'un trauma, en y ajoutant d'autres, ce qu'on va appeler plus tard la Torah orale, la Mishnah, Tosefta, les Talmuds, etc. Donc en fait, c'est la naissance du judaïsme tel qu'on connaît, d'abord à Yavne en Galilée, mais bien sûr aussi dans d'autres endroits, notamment à Babylone. Donc bien sûr, après, ça va être l'identité pour des milliers de personnes, mais à l'origine, c'est l'œuvre d'un tout petit groupe de quelques intellectuels savants qui ont trouvé refuge dans ce petit ville de Yavne.
Merci. All right. So meanwhile, As I mentioned in my initial summary, there was another form of Second Temple Judaism at the time. It was a group of Jews initially gathered around Jesus of Nazareth, who is later publicly executed by the Romans as an insurrectionist Jewish leader. These followers of Jesus were all initially Jewish, including the Apostle Paul, who was an observant Pharisaic Jew. Now, of course, I need to emphasize here that for this group of Second Temple Jews, even before the destruction of the Second Temple, there was an earlier trauma. And that was the public humiliating, stripping, torture, and public execution of Jesus, their founder, accused of rebellion against Rome. Now, in viewing the Roman execution of Jesus on the cross, we must be clear on what crucifixion was used for by the Romans. Crucifixion was not just a means of inflicting terrifying pain on an individual. In many, if not most cases, the Romans attempted to suppress rebellious movements by publicly torturing, humiliating, and killing the leaders and key members of such rebellious movements. Thus, a cross was not just painful and deadly for the person killed, of course it was. It was a way that the Romans tried to ensure that no one ever followed that person again. And it's important then to understand this as a context for the impact of the crucifixion on the Jesus movement, a Jesus movement before there was Christianity. The Roman crucifixion of Jesus qualified for that tiny group of Second Temple Jews as a traumatic event that they needed to find a way to process. And indeed, like Jews dealing with suffering at various stages in this process, these Jesus followers used the resources of the Hebrew scripture, especially the Song of the Suffering Servant, which itself was formed amidst an earlier trauma, to reinterpret the Roman execution of Jesus as part of a larger narrative of death and resurrection. For them, Moses was the original suffering servant. So they brought the Moses tradition together with the suffering servant song and put it together and saw Moses as dying at the edge of the land on behalf of his people so that they could enter the land. But now, the Jesus followers, trying to understand the Roman crucifixion of Jesus, saw him as a Moses-like suffering servant, dying at the hands of the Romans on behalf of his people so that they could enter eternal life. This sort of reinterpretation of Jewish scripture, forged in trauma of Babylonian exile, helped the Jesus movement of the Roman period survive the Roman execution of Jesus and even get stronger from it. Meanwhile, there was another important development. Some members of the Jesus movement, like Paul, reinterpreted traditions surrounding Abraham to affirm the idea that Gentiles, non-Jews, could join the Jesus movement without being circumcised, at least not getting circumcised right away, or observing other Jewish customs. These Jesus movement followers, like many Jews of the time, believed they were living at the end of the world. And the only thing from their perspective that was important in the midst of this situation of crisis was for Gentile converts to the Jesus movement to renounce other gods and follow Jesus. Still, for Paul and others around him, this Jesus movement was still firmly Jewish. Indeed, they argued with their fellow Jews that their form of what might be termed Jesus Judaism was more faithfully Jewish than Pharisaism or other competing movements. So there's a competition in this first century over who gets to be called truly Jewish. And indeed, much of the Christian Gospels of Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and the writings of Paul are textual arguments for the claims of this Jesus Judaism over against other forms of Judaism in the first century. So it's in the midst of this trauma of Roman crucifixion of Jesus and the growing Gentile presence in the Jesus movement that we see the destruction of Jerusalem happen, and the caricature of Jews as rebels, arsonists, troublemakers, enemies of the state. And in the midst of this situation, the Jesus movement identification with other Jews begins to separate. For the Jesus movement found itself in a difficult position amidst this Jewish unrest inside and outside Palestine. Most members of Jesus movement churches rejected their association with the emergent rabbinic movement. Meanwhile, other Jews looking on this ever more Gentile Jesus movement had trouble recognizing them as Jewish, as Jews, especially as the number of Gentiles in the Jesus movement increased.
Voilà, mais en même temps, comme dirait l'autre, en même temps, il y a un autre mouvement, un mouvement juif autour de Jésus, mouvement réformateur, qui se considère tout à fait comme juif et qui se légitime après un premier traumatisme, à savoir la crucifixion, l'exécution de leur chef Jésus, comme étant en fait les vrais juifs, en utilisant notamment les chants du serviteur souffrant, qui est identifié d'abord à Moïse, et Jésus en fait identifié comme un deuxième Moïse. Comme Moïse n'a pas pu entrer dans le pays, Jésus a dû mourir, mais sa mort signifie en fait la résurrection. Les gens autour de Jésus, comme aussi Paul, et bien encore les évangélistes, ou certains évangélistes, en fait, présentent en fait ce groupe autour de Jésus comme étant le vrai judaïsme, un judaïsme très marqué par l'idée apocalyptique d'une fin du monde imminente, et donc aussi par une ouverture aux païens, avec l'idée que la circoncision, par exemple, n'est pas nécessaire pour faire partir de ce mouvement de Jésus. La séparation, en fait, avec le judaïsme va être accélérée par la destruction du temple, puisqu'à ce moment-là, comme nous l'avons vu, les Juifs sont considérés comme étant des révoltés, des rebelles hostiles à l'Empire romain. Et du coup, ce groupe autour de Jésus va de plus en plus se distancer du judaïsme traditionnel.
Merci. So already I've discussed ways in which Jesus movement Judaism was beginning to separate, at least in certain places, from other forms of Judaism. But this could happen more or less at different places and could be a very random process. But there were a set of events that led to a more broad and decisive separation of Jesus Judaism from other forms of Judaism. And it has to do with the changing Roman attitude toward the Jesus movement. Because the Romans didn't like the Jesus movement at all. Indeed, Jesus Judaism, as I'm calling it, represented for the Romans a particularly toxic, poisonous form of Judaism. Unlike other forms of Judaism, and this is where we get back to what I said about legalized atheism, unlike other forms of Judaism, the Jesus movement focused on converting Gentiles away from worship of former gods. Moreover, its founder, Jesus, was known to have been executed as an insurrectionist by the Romans. And we see these associations come together in the quote that is up here in the PowerPoint from the Roman historian Tacitus, who writes from the early half of the second century. He's writing about the scapegoating of Christians by Nero in 64 CE, also related to a fire in Rome, where he says, "Nero substituted his culprits and punished with the utmost refinements of cruelty a class of men loathed for their vices, whom the crowd styled Christians. Christus, the founder of the name, had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate, but the pernicious superstition was checked only for a moment, only to break out once more, not only in Judea, the home of the disease, but in the capital itself, where all things horrible or shameful in the world collect and find a vogue. End of quote. So Tacitus is writing, of course, as I said, from a later period, the early second century, when the term Christian was starting to be used for the community of Jesus followers. Actually, the term Christian only appears once in the New Testament. Usually they call themselves members of the way or that kind of thing. And Tacitus' use of his term then is anachronistic. But his comments well illustrate the developing Roman attitude toward Jesus Judaism as a pernicious superstition, founded and named after a convicted and executed anti-Roman insurrectionist. The concept of Christianity as a disease, in this quote, might be imagined as, to use a cancer analogy, malignant monotheism. For Tacitus and other Romans like him, Christianity appears to be a form of metastasizing atheism, a missionary monotheism that threatens to spread rejection of ancient gods from Judah to the city of Rome itself. Thus, especially as Judaism is fragmenting in this time with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, we see an increasing tendency of many Jews and Romans to distinguish between missionary, reputedly seditious Christian Judaism from other forms of Judaism that are gradually, very gradually, being organized around the rabbinic vision. And this was encouraged by the increasingly Gentile cast of much of the Jesus movement that led Jews to reject members of that movement as non-legitimate Judaism. Meanwhile, Christian communities increasingly understood themselves as distinct from observant Judaism, trying to claim for themselves the Roman exception that granted Judaism as an ancient religion permission not to worship the emperor and otherwise participate in the state religion of Rome. So many of the arguments you see in the New Testament about Jesus being a fulfillment of Jewish scriptures are attempts by this Jesus movement to claim the legitimacy of Judaism for their form of monotheism and thus not be prosecuted for refusing to worship the imperial gods. At the end of the first century, then, Rome plays an important role in defining Christianity as non-Jewish. First, the Emperor Domitian, 81 to 96, who's pictured up in the upper bust, is said by Suetonius to have severely enforced the Jewish poll tax, prosecuting those who, without publicly acknowledging their faith, yet lived as Jews, end of quote. Now, there's much debate about exactly which group he's talking about here, but this initiative seems to involve a move toward using Jewish observance of legal matters as a key test for determining who is or is not a Jew. This takes then another turn with Domitian's successor, Nerva, pictured below, who reforms the Jewish tax, the Fiscus Judaicus, applying it only to Torah-observant Jews. In this way, through the temple tax, Rome now defined much of the Jesus movement as non-Jewish Christianism. Now, I have to be clear here, this probably had little effect on how Christians were actually treated, at least initially. Despite the later mythology of Christian martyrdom, there was no widespread persecution of Christians until 250. And it now appears that real incidents of local persecution of Christians was far fewer than is often supposed. Indeed, most important for our purposes is what Nerva's reform of the Jewish poll tax meant in redefining both Judaism and Christianity in a way that they stood as separate religions. Previously, as I've emphasized, Judaism had been an ethnic designation, albeit one that had a significant religious component. If you were a Judean, whether inside or outside Palestine, you were Jewish. And that counted also for the Jewish followers of Jesus. Now, however, it was not enough to be ethnically Jewish. Being Jewish after Nerva's reforms meant following ancestral Jewish or Judean customs, the Torah, with those Torah customs increasingly defined by the emergent rabbinic movement that I discussed in the first half of my lecture. Most churches of the Jesus movement fell outside this definition, since most Jesus followers by this point did not follow basic Jewish practices around circumcision of male babies, Sabbath, dietary rules, and so on, let alone following the Torah rulings of the rabbinic academy. I'll pause again for summary.
Dans le Nouveau Testament, en fait, on parle juste une fois des chrétiens. On trouve encore beaucoup le terme « ceux qui suivent la voie » pour parler des chrétiens. Donc, pendant un moment, le mouvement de Jésus voulait être en effet reconnu comme étant juif. Et beaucoup de textes dans le Nouveau Testament, lorsque Jésus dit qu'il faut payer les taxes à César, où on insiste sur le fait que Jésus est venu pour accomplir la Torah, c'est en effet à comprendre comme une tentative en effet d'être reconnu comme faisant partie du judaïsme. Le problème pour les Romains, c'est surtout que c'est un judaïsme missionnaire et qui en fait veut détourner du culte de l'empereur et du culte des divinités romaines. Et c'est ça qui va poser les premiers problèmes avec les Romains. Il faut aussi rappeler, comme le fait le professeur Carr, que la vision traditionnelle des grandes persécutions est sans doute largement exagérée. On n'a pas vraiment des traces avant 250 et même après, il semble que les persécutions soient moins importantes qu'on le pense. Néanmoins, les Romains introduisent la séparation par cette idée de l'empereur Nerva qui, en fait, va redéfinir la taxe juive en les limitant, en fait, à ceux qui pratiquent la Torah dans son intégralité, ce qui, évidemment, n'est plus le cas pour les futurs chrétiens qui refusent la circoncision, certain nombre d'observances de la Torah, de la loi, et donc, du fait, cette séparation se met en place. Ce qui, évidemment, aussi implique que la définition du judaïsme comme groupe ethnique ne fonctionne plus non plus, puisque maintenant, c'est vraiment autour de l'observance de la Torah que va se définir le juif.
All right. So, this is part of where we have to reform the way we look at these two religious traditions. Thank you. How we look at these religious traditions from the perspective of the time, because up to this point, people would not have been using the term Christian. They would have called these people Jews or followers of the way or whatever. It's right around this time, the late first century, early second century, that we first see appear in datable texts the use of the term Christian to refer to these followers of Jesus, these Second Temple Jesus Jews. And this designation, as I've said, appears to be a term of derision, of insult, used by pagans to link Jesus followers to their criminal founder, Jesus. As I said, Tacitus writes of how the crowd styled Jesus followers as Christians, and then he mentions Christus as the convicted and executed anti-Roman criminal. The letter 1 Peter 4:16, a late first century text, stresses that if any of you suffers as a Christian, do not consider it a disgrace, but glorify God because you bear this name, end of quote. So this late first century comment in this letter seems to be answering a concern in the community that there might be a disgrace in bearing this term Christian. And 1 Peter is one of several bits of evidence to suggest that members of the Jesus movement came to accept this pejorative designation of themselves as Christians. So a term that starts out as an outsider term for the movement comes to be accepted by the movement itself. Now, scholars of the New Testament, I realize at this point I'm summarizing a lot of stuff quite quickly, and especially for this lecture, but also for the others, I had this handout, which I think you all have, right? Which has some bibliography that summarizes some of the stuff I'll go over quickly here. But New Testament scholars are agreed that the Gospels of the New Testament were written at the close of the first century, so decades after the time of Jesus, or soon after, responding to the situation of the Roman destruction of the temple and of Second Temple Judaism. And in this last section of my lecture, I want to take a brief look at one text from the New Testament, the Gospel of Mark, which was likely written in the wake of that temple destruction. And it uses, again, the exilic image, the trauma-formed image of the suffering servant, to interpret both Jesus' crucifixion and also to anticipate and interpret the suffering of Jesus' followers, both present and future. And the author doesn't actually really know how much persecution there will be, but anticipates there will be a lot of persecution. Now, of course, when we read the Gospel of Mark, at least for many Christians, but others too, it's hard to read it as anything other than a simple historical record of what actually happened with Jesus. But as I said, centuries of academic work on the Gospels has shown that even this, our likely earliest written Gospel, is as much a confession of theological faith as it is a historical record. That scholarship of New Testament has established that the Gospel of Mark was written long after the crucifixion traditions that only start to be discussed in Mark 10 and the letters of Paul. And in its stories of Jesus' disputes with Jewish authorities are probably emphasized and even elaborated on in the Gospel of Mark in light of later Jesus movement conflicts with other forms of Judaism. So they read their conflicts with other forms of Judaism back into the story of Jesus so that Jesus, say, is fighting with Pharisees about who is the has the proper claim to the heritage of Judaism. We see this, for example, even at the first chapters, where there's a bunch of healing stories, which likely have an earlier oral history to them in Mark 2 to 3, which culminate in the decision in the Gospel of Mark of the Jewish leaders to crucify Jesus. This reshaping of those healing stories so it aims toward the later crucifixion of Jesus is part of how the author of the Gospel of Mark is reshaping the story of Jesus to interpret Jesus' crucifixion and also negotiate relations with other Jews. In particular, I want to focus here, though, on ways in which the Gospel of Mark echoes certain wording that's found in the Suffering Servant Song of Isaiah 53, particularly in the Greek translation of it, the Septuagint, which talks at multiple points about how the suffering servant was given over to death. So also, the Gospel of Mark talks about, first of all, John the Baptist, who's seen as a model for Jesus, being given over. And then Judas is identified as a disciple who gave Jesus over to death. So, and then finally, Jesus himself in Mark 9:31 predicts to his disciples that he will be handed over, given over to death. In all these ways, the Gospel of Mark puts into Jesus' mouth and into other descriptions of characters, characterizations of Jesus as a suffering servant-like figure who's given over to death. But most importantly, the author of this late first century gospel tells the story of Jesus so that Jesus' death is part of a broader story of the destruction of the Second Temple and future persecution of Jesus' disciples. So when Jesus predicts his own death, he calls on his disciples to take up their cross and follow him. And then his description of the destruction of the Second Temple includes the admonition that is quoted up here. Now here again, we have to be aware this is a late first century author placing words into Jesus' mouth that anticipate a destruction of the Second Temple that his readers know about. He says to his readers, "Be on your guard. You will be handed over to Sanhedrins. You will be beaten in synagogues. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake as evidence to them, since the gospel must be proclaimed to the nations. And when you are to be handed over," hear this language of suffering servant. Now the followers of Jesus are becoming the suffering servants. "When you are taken to be handed over, do not worry beforehand about what to say. No, say whatever is given to you at the time comes, because it's not you who will be speaking, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will come forth against their parents and have them put to death. You will be universally hated on account of my name. But anyone who stands firm to the end will be saved. I don't know if you could hear in this quote various echoes of the dynamics I've been talking about before. The emergent conflict between Jesus' Judaism and other forms of Judaism, the possible persecution that these Jesus Jews were afraid would happen in the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple, and in particular, this increasing idea that members of this movement are known by the name Christ of their criminal founder, but have taken on that designation for themselves. In the wake of this, sort of marks Jesus predicting this late Second Temple period in chapter 13 of the Gospel of Mark. We then see in chapters 14 to 15 of Mark the description of Jesus' gradual betrayal and eventual crucifixion. So where early Jesus traditions saw Jesus' death on analogy with that of Moses and the suffering servant, this is something the author of Mark already had. The author of Mark's Gospel now takes Jesus' death at the hands of Roman authorities as the first example of suffering like the suffering servant, one that then anticipates his followers' destiny to follow him in that path and become suffering servants themselves in the midst of the end of the world. So, thus we see two religions emerge from the early Judaism that preceded Roman trauma. Rabbinic Judaism and an increasingly Gentile Christianity. Let me pause before I conclude, though, and let Thomas talk about what I've covered so far.
Donc le terme chrétien était d'abord un terme, d'après ce qu'on sait, péjoratif donné par d'autres à ce groupe autour de Jésus, qui ensuite a été adopté. C'est aussi une manière, en fait, de gérer le traumatisme, en reprenant ce terme péjoratif, en le prenant comme un terme, en fait, de gloire. Si on regarde maintenant l'évangile de Marc, donc tous les évangiles présupposent déjà la destruction du temple, on voit là une nouvelle stratégie en fait par rapport à ce qu'on a pu voir avec le mouvement de Jésus qui avait d'abord compris le serviteur souffrant comme se référant à Jésus. Maintenant en fait ce que va faire l'auteur de l'évangile de Marc, il va mettre en parallèle en fait les deux événements traumatisants, à savoir la mort de Jésus et la destruction du temple de Jérusalem. C'est-à-dire qu'elle va lier les deux et il va voir dans la mort de Jésus une sorte d'anticipation en fait de la destruction du temple. Donc il faut vous rappeler que beaucoup de textes dans l'évangile de Marc, évidemment, ne reflètent pas des événements de l'époque de Jésus, mais reflètent en fait déjà les conflits entre ces futurs chrétiens et d'autres groupes du judaïsme. Donc lorsque Jésus discute avec les pharisiens ou les sadducéens, en fait, ça reflète des discussions et des conflits au moment où l'évangile de Jean est mis par écrit.
Merci beaucoup. Before I finish, I just want to say I've always appreciated Thomas as a wonderful scholar, innovative, revolutionary bridge builder, but I do have a new appreciation now for you as an exegete, having listened to me and so nicely summarized what I have to say over and over again in such beautiful, crisp, clear ways. In some ways, I feel like you could just give the lecture. So thank you so much. So we conclude here with two religions that emerge out of the destruction of the Second Temple. Rabbinic Judaism is built on concepts of holy peoplehood, of Israel, that originated in Judah's earlier exilic and post-exilic trauma. And this vision of Rabbinic Judaism proved amazingly resilient, not just in the face of Roman trauma, but in helping the Jewish people confront and survive centuries of later Gentile persecution of Judaism. Meanwhile, the Gentile church proved increasingly successful in its missionary efforts. Just a tiny little group of Second Temple Jews eventually grew to become a substantial portion of the late Roman Empire, significantly larger in number than rabbinic Judaism and any other forms of Judaism that survived the Jewish wars. And in this sense, Rome was right to fear Christianity might end up replacing traditional local and imperial religion. In time, it did. By 380, Christianity was declared the official religion of the Roman Empire. And then the power of the Roman state that had once been used to try to eliminate Christian atheism was turned against non-Christian cults that the Christian monotheism rejected. Now, in the midst of this time, Judaism, as it had before, enjoyed the uneasy protection of its status as a tolerated religion in this now Christian version of the Roman Empire, even as Jews remained vulnerable to local disturbances. Interestingly enough, monotheism took different forms in these two religions as well. On the one hand, within rabbinic Judaism, because it was a non-missionary religion, there was an explicit toleration of the idea that other people worshipped other gods. Christianity, on the other hand, ended up enforcing a harder version of God-rejecting monotheism. Not only did it insist on its converts disassociating themselves from any form of worship of other gods than the God of Israel, but when it became the religion of Rome, it began to suppress all forms of non-Jewish religion. And although this suppression was not immediately successful, but it only affected areas covered by the severely reduced late Roman Empire. But be that as it may, the religious world of the West, the ideological world of the West, is a product of these massive shifts. The Romans, of course, had thought that they could eliminate Judaism by destroying the temple, killing thousands of Judeans, and persecuting them with a temple tax. And they thought they could end the Jesus movement by crucifying its founder. And there were later episodic attempts, especially in the third century, to eliminate Christianity as it grew. But all these efforts, all the bloodshed and communities destroyed, did the opposite of what Rome intended. And out of all of the trauma came these two religions, rabbinic Judaism and what came to be termed Christianity. Rome, at least initially, had superior powers of violence on its side, powers that it used to put down Jewish revolts and suppress Christianity. Judaism and Christianity, in contrast, could build on a heritage of centuries of survival of trauma: Assyrian, Babylonian, Hellenistic, and Roman. And it was Judaism and Christianity that continued into the millennia that followed. Ultimately, Western culture carries ideas and symbols that helped ancient communities survive their trauma. If there's anything like a survival of the fittest culture, to use an evolutionary analogy, the religions of Judaism and Christianity would qualify as among the religions that won that competition. Where more glorious myths of more powerful nations faded away with those empires, the scriptures of Christianity and Judaism, forged in the furnace of trauma, survived and shaped the lives of millions of people today. Thank you.
Voilà, donc si vous voulez plus de détails, vous pouvez acquérir ce livre. Je vais brièvement rappeler la conclusion. Donc l'idée, c'est que à la fin de l'Empire romain, on a en effet deux religions qui vont se développer différemment. Le christianisme que les Romains ont tellement craint devient religion officielle en 380 de l'Empire romain, qui est déjà un peu vers sa fin, alors que le judaïsme va rester une religion de diaspora. On peut aussi observer que le christianisme en tant que religion d'État et aussi en tant que religion missionnaire va avoir en fait une forme plus dure, d'une certaine manière, une version plus dure, intolérante au monothéisme que le judaïsme qui, dans certains milieux, en effet, va avoir des visions plus tolérants. Donc ce qu'on peut apprendre de tout cela, c'est que ce n'est pas forcément les empires qui vont rester, mais c'est des groupes qui vont développer des stratégies de comment survivre face à des traumatismes. Et puis c'est justement ces longues séries de traumatismes assyriens, puis babyloniens, hellénistiques et romains qui sont à l'origine d'abord du judaïsme, mais aussi du christianisme. Voilà, alors on peut prendre encore quelques questions.